Over the course of our year-long film series, Political Projections, we've looked at a number of different ways Hollywood has depicted politics, campaigns, machine politics, idealism. But today's segment is devoted to just one man, Richard Nixon. The three films we've chosen are Nixon, All the President's Men, and Dick. And joining me now are Rick Perlstein, author of Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America, and from England, Brian Neff, a professor of cultural studies at the University of Bath and author of Ilya Kazan, The Cinema of an American Outsider, which will be published this December. I'm very pleased to welcome the two of them to Political Projections today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
Hi there.
And by the way, to our audience, if you've watched the movies and want to post your reactions, you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Rick, what is it about Nixon's story that has attracted so many filmmakers?
You know, it's an interesting question because, of course, this December we have coming out Ron Howard's film, the Frost Nixon. You know, Oliver Stone just came out with a new DVD. There's a play on called Nixon's Nixon, which is being revived in Chicago. I think it has to be the fact that he combines that sort of venality that we all know about. You know, we all know what a crooked and evil man he was. But he had that astonishing everyman quality. And, you know, without that, he wouldn't have been able to achieve, you know, such strange and inexplicable popularity. So, you know, it's a combination of, I think, venality and the everyman quality that really kind of suggests the evil that kind of hypothetically lurks in all of us.
He's a tragic figure, the sort that perhaps Shakespeare might have been attracted to.
Very Shakespearean.
Richard III, although not as bad as Richard III. Brian, let's discuss the 1995 movie that bears his name, Nixon, directed by Oliver Stone and starring Anthony Hopkins. The movie begins with a disclaimer that it's a dramatic interpretation of events and characters based on numerous public sources and on an incomplete historical record. So how much of the film, then, is a speculation on Oliver Stone's part?
Well, I think there's a large amount of speculation, but it is fairly based on the historical record. But what you're getting, as well as a sort of documentary account, is Oliver Stone's particular kind of pastiche and mixing of different kinds of footage, of black and white, of Nixon's own memory of historical circumstances, a great mix of ideas which he's using, really, not only to look at Nixon's time, but also to some extent to get what Rick was talking about there, really, the tragedy of the Willie Loman within Dick Nixon, really, the way in which he, as many people feel, had the capacity to do better, but in the end failed.
So some of the script is actually a recreation of real events, only with Anthony Hopkins playing Richard Nixon.
Yeah, so I think Anthony Hopkins certainly, he doesn't try to imitate Nixon, but you know, I think it's a commanding sort of performance, really, as the spotlight is on him throughout the whole film, as he interacts with people in the White House, and we see him in the past as well. You know, he and his sense of guilt, his sense of coming to the White House really on the back of the bodies of his two brothers who died, and then his strange relationship with the Kennedys, for the fact that he always saw himself as somehow not as good somehow as the Kennedys, to whom he always saw as a great a kind of alternative sort of mythology, really.
Rick, you've written about Nixon. How does the film compared to the research that you did for your biography?
Yeah, it's curious. When I first saw it, when it came out, knowing a little bit about Nixon, I was very impressed. I thought it was Oliver Stone's best. When I just saw it again for this segment, I couldn't even make it to the end.
You were so upset?
I feel like an awful pedant in a sense. You know, like, oh, he didn't meet John Mitchell until 1965, not 1963. But by the same token, the whole narrative arc of the film basically implies that kind of Nixon is a captive of events, that there are these unseen forces, the FBI, the CIA. There's that famous scene, which, you know,
more or less actually happened at the Lincoln Memorial, in which he's confronted by these young protesters, and one of the kids, one of the young women says, "Oh, you're not even in control of the events. The events are controlling you."
Well, let's take a little break and actually listen to a clip from that scene, okay? Then we can follow up on it.
There's more at stake here. What you want or what I want.
Then what's the point? What's the point of being president? You're powerless.
No. No, I'm not powerless. Because I understand the system, I believe I can control it. Maybe not control it totally, but tame it enough to make it do some good.
Sounds like you're talking about a wild animal.
Yeah, maybe I am.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, first of all, my guests are Rick Perlstein and Brian Neff, and we're talking about Richard Nixon as the subject of films over the years. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So, Rick, do you think the notion of the system as an uncontrollable beast was the real theme that Oliver Stone wanted to deal with in the film?
I think so, and it ends up being kind of perverse. I think it has a lot to do with his kind of baby boomer nostalgia for Camelot, and it almost seems like a setup for the moment in the film where he's able to say, one of the characters is able to say, well, JFK didn't even know about the attempts to assassinate Castro. You know, this idea that if the CIA is kind of darkly manipulating everything and no one's in control, well, then, you know, Kennedy wasn't in control, which is this, you know, kind of idea that Oliver Stone seems to be enamored of. But Nixon was an absolute obsessive about control. He had his finger in every pie. In fact, he reorganized the White House to make it impossible for him not to know what was going on everywhere and at every time. So, you know, I found it kind of wildly swinging on the mark, off the mark, even though I thought, you know, psychologically the portrait was quite rich and resonant and pretty much accurate, I think.
Well, the film asserts that Nixon was part of a plan to assassinate Castro, which in turn led to a series of events that culminated in the assassination of John Kennedy.
Right.
And Nixon's daughters really protested that.
Yeah. And in JFK, he blames Lyndon Johnson for you know, killing Kennedy. So I got a little confused.
Well, he hired Robert McNamara and John Dean to act as consultants on the film. Do you think that they went along with any of this?
No, I don't think so. I think when you're a historical consultant on a film, you know, a lot of what you're asked about is, you know, what color tie did someone wear, and, you know, where was this room relative to this room in the White House. I'm sure he didn't give them final cut on the historical texture of the film.
Brian, in an interview with Cineast magazine, Oliver Stone said, in response to criticism that he was presenting a warped view of history, he said, "Movies are just the first draft. They raise questions and inspire students to find out more." Do you think he was being disingenuous there?
Well, no. I like the film more. I agree in the sense it doesn't work quite as well the second time you view it. But I mean, this was the whole kind of argument about JFK, that it kind of caused and it really raised questions of fundamental sort of ideas about the Kennedy assassination. And here I think you've got a mixture between the sort of notion of conspiracy theory and a real sense of the system being more than the individual president. And, you know, from looking at things from Britain, certainly American film tends to be dominated by individual heroes who have agency. And here is somebody who doesn't have agency. And though I think that realization when he comes away from the Lincoln Memorial and he says, well, perhaps she's right, perhaps this young 19-year-old is right, that I am riding the beast in some ways. I think it has something to say about it. I think it's also interesting that there's some quite interesting references to Citizen Kane, which is, again, plants the film very much in terms of the sort of tragic everyman American.
Although there was that ominous music in the background that suggested almost a spooky film there. How much fictionalization is acceptable when you're using real names? Should you change the name of the character and call it a film based on a true story when you go so far from the historical record?
I don't really think you can possibly, you know, to change the names when clearly it is the the evidence of the or an essay on the Nixon presidency. I think Nixon, you know, films can never be a kind of historic. They're not the second draft of history, the third draft. They're not an academic piece, and indeed academic pieces are continually disputing with each other. But they do, I think, when Hollywood cares to make them, really raise interesting discussions and question issues. And I think this film does successfully do that.
Why do you think that Oliver Stone used Anthony Hopkins, who doesn't even try to do an American accent, to play Nixon?
That's a good question.
And because there are many British actors who do very good American accents.
Yeah. I think, though, that... when you're watching the film, the nearly 3 hours of it, you begin to, and perhaps Americans are more conscious of this, but I mean, you begin to lose a sense of whether this is Nixon, and you just think of this individual sweating before you, and you know, looking at that painting at the end and saying, painting of JFK, and saying that when people kind of look at JFK, they look at what they want to be, and when they look at him, they look at what they are. Perhaps it's a sentimental thing, but I think that works in the film, as well as all the issues, the sort of, in a sense, the attempt to put in a good word for Nixon as a sort of centrist Republican before the much more conservative kind of Republicans of the later period, and to look at his foreign policy, Brezhnev and Mao Zedong, and the applause on Air Force One. You know, the film tries to look at things from a different from perspectives, I think.
Rick, the film suggests that Nixon's insecurities stem from his childhood, and it focuses on the role those insecurities played in his key decisions that he made while he was president. Was that what you learned when you were writing Nixon Land?
That's absolutely central to my approach, and that's the part of the film that I think is most maturely and kind of calmly and sophisticatedly realized. I mean, he was someone who always felt like someone was looking down at him, and his key political insight, which goes back to his first election for student body president in college, is that there are more people who feel looked down upon than people who feel secure in their kind of social status. And again and again throughout his career, and this is depicted quite effectively, I think, in the kind of Citizen Kane-like newsreel movements, he's depicted basically appealing to people who feel looked down upon, people who feel silenced, people who feel voiceless. Of course, most famously, he gave that group the designation the Silent Majority. And, just as a pedant, he calls them the Silent Majority during his nomination speech in 1968, even though he didn't say it until 1969. I'll let that go. I think a lot of dramatic license is acceptable. I think it made actually the film, in a sense, less dramatic than it could have been, not more dramatic.
My guests are Rick Perlstein, author of Nixon Land, and Brian Neve, professor of cultural studies at University of Bath in England. And we will continue our conversation about the films where Richard Nixon is a key figure after this. We're back with Rick Perlstein and Brian Neve talking about the movies of that feature Richard Nixon, at least three. There are more, and it's part of our political projection series. Our second film, Dick, portrays the Washington, the Watergate scandal in a substantially different light. Rick, could you give us a brief summary of the plot?
Basically, it's almost like a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead kind of take on Watergate, where two teenage girls who are trying to post their entry into the Bobby Sherman, win a date with Bobby Sherman contest, and happen to live in the Watergate apartment complex, are rushing out late at night, and they tape the door in a way that any Watergate buff will find familiar, the wrong way, and the security guard gets suspicious and manages to find that at the same time a burglary is going on, and then by a strange, almost Dickensian set of coincidences, the girls happen to be at the White House the next day, see Gordon Liddy, and are prepared to drop the dime about this awful crime and end up as the kind of deus ex machinas responsible for being Deep Throat and the 18.5-minute gap. It's fiendishly clever, and it almost kind of defies a summary. It's quite a unique picture.
Well, here's a clip in which Richard Nixon, played by Dan Hedaya, confers with Henry Kissinger, played by Saul Rubinek, and with Arlene and Betsy, who are played by Kirsten Dunst and Michelle Williams. At this point, they have become the official White House dog walkers.
Mr. President, really, we have to make a decision regarding offensive action north of the 22nd parallel right away.
Bottom line, Henry, is we bomb them or we don't, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, I wouldn't put it exactly in
that. I have something to say.
Go on, Arlene.
War is not healthy for children and other living things.
Yeah.
Henry, that's the voice of the youth of America.
Rick, who do you think was the prime audience for this film?
You know, I think it was me and my wife. I mean, I remember when we saw it in DuPont Circle in Washington when it came out in 1999. I mean, we're a couple who, of course, you know, like all couples, talked about Nixon nonstop on their first date. And, you know, we like, stared at each other right there, and we couldn't believe how clever a depiction of kind of the world of Nixon and Watergate it was, but how much kind of knowledge you had to bring into it to appreciate it. So, I mean, I think I read some of the reviews that came out at the time. It got terrible reviews because it was kind of in the tone of a Harold and Komar go to White Castle, but, you know, with the kind of, you know, historical sophistication of someone who sits around reading, you know, Winston Churchill books all day. So I think the Venn diagram of people it intersected with was pretty narrow.
Brian, were Michelle Williams and Kirsten Dunst already stars at this point?
No, I mean, I don't think this film really got much play over here. I just recently had to get it to see it. I quite like the film. It's certainly very clever in terms of how it looks at the whole Watergate event from the standpoint of these two 15-year-olds, and there's a sort of growing up and a loss of innocence that their discoveries, their kind of accidental almost discoveries of the events indicate. But it got very little coverage over here.
Well, you have to wonder what a young person who didn't really live through the time would think as a result. They would get a whole distorted view of the what happened during Watergate. Although, I don't know, Rick, Dick seems to convey a sense of general incompetence around the people in office.
Yeah.
Was that true?
Well, the people who put together the actual Watergate burglary, of course, were famously incompetent, but there were plenty of competent people around the White House. I mean, I saw it as kind of almost in the tradition of kind of idiot savant comedies about American politics. I mean, you have your Being There and your kind of Dave, and this kind of idea that American politics is so silly that kind of, you know, anyone can do it. You know, and I thought it kind of carried that off with incredible wit. You know, nothing about it was accurate. It was broadly farcical. And
yeah, there's a danger, though, isn't there, of these films being more the films of the sort of ages of cynicism about politics, and really for all its sort of pretentiousness, you know, Nixon was a film which kind of, you know, demanded to be taken seriously in terms of its sort of depictions,
certainly with its Citizen Kane quotations.
Well, that's right. Whereas Dick, I mean, it really doesn't explain anything in terms of, I mean, not only does it, you know, Will Ferrell is Bob Woodward, and so they are kind of completely kind of camp comic figures in a way, and nor does it really go much further explaining the political, legal, constitutional elements to it. It's a nice film which would sort of raise issues about Watergate, but it wouldn't actually provide many answers, I don't think.
Well, in his review in the New York Times, Stephen Holden wrote that the movie, I'm quoting, would probably not have been made had Monica Lewinsky never slunk into the Oval Office.
Yeah.
He was suggesting that Dick was a sly comment of Bill Clinton as much as it was about Richard Nixon.
Well, I think that the joke in that was the kind of sexlessness of Richard Nixon contrasted with the raw bust bursting charisma of Bill Clinton. And there's what I thought was a hilarious moment in which one of the girls recorded an 18.5-minute love letter to Richard Nixon. And that's so incongruous and so strange. Hunter S. Thompson used to supposedly ask Nixon if he had his one orgasm that year. I think he asked Ron Ziggs with that. And even in the Stone film, he was basically supplicated by a prostitute and turns her away. So it's kind of Nixon's sexlessness contrasted with kind of Clinton's raw vitality, I think, is a pretty good joke, actually.
Well, Dan Hedaya actually ties the two films together because he plays Richard Nixon here. He had a small role in the Oliver Stone movie. Do you think he was a convincing Nixon, or was he no more convincing than Anthony Hopkins?
I didn't think he was more convincing, really. There were one or two ways in which the Dick film did actually present a slightly more unvarnished sort of, even a few years earlier, the Oliver Stone film was slightly reverential in some ways about Nixon, whereas Dick, even discusses anti-Semitism, for example, which doesn't sort of raise its head at all in the Stone film.
You get the feeling that Dick might have also been a spoof on our final film, All the President's Men. You mentioned that Will Ferrell, also Bruce McCulloch, play Woodward and Bernstein, and they're bumbling characters, totally the opposite of the sterling journalists that they are in All the President's Men. Nixon does appear in All the President's Men, but only the real Nixon in news footage. Otherwise, he's sort of like negative space. Should we even call it a Nixon film then?
Well, I think it's a film which is built around, shows obviously it's a film which enormously emphasizes the journalistic process, the bright light, the sterile bright light of the Washington Post newsroom against the black and darkness, the famous dark side of the Nixon White House. And it was made by Alan J. Pakula, who'd made Parallax View and Clute in the 70s, those kind of conspiratorial films that indicated the dark side of American politics. But it had a very strong sort of documentary feel, I think, from the William Goldman script.
Yeah, it's more like a process film, isn't it?
Yeah, police procedural almost.
And it supposedly was the inspiration for David Fincher's Zodiac, which came out last year, again, a process film. Let's listen to a little clip in which Carl Bernstein has just been interviewing a woman who worked for the committee to reelect the president, is telling Bob Woodward what he has learned.
In 1 6-day period, over $6 million came in. You wouldn't believe what was going on inside that woman. I mean, the stuff was just ready to pour out of her, and I'm pouring down the cups of coffee trying to get it out of her before she throws me out of the house.
Okay, give me your notes so I can.
These
get
are
it down,
the notes.
These are the notes?
Yeah, I got stuff on napkins, matchbook, because I'm writing in the bathroom while she's getting the coffee. I'm a walking litter basket.
You're crazy.
Here.
How am I going
to? Well, you'd be crazy, too, if you were operating on 20 cups of coffee.
Part of the drama of the film is that it accurately describes their attempts to learn the story when nobody else seemed to be interested.
Yeah, it's a tragic film. It's a very sad film because, of course, it ends with some kind of flash forwards of the various stories they write afterwards, but it ends with Nixon winning his landslide, despite their heroic efforts. So, and I found it fascinating that it came out, a couple months before the bicentennial celebration, and supposedly it inspired all these people to become, crusading investigative journalists. But it's this sad kind of 70s dark movie about kind of the futility of investigative journalism, because as he points out, which is quite accurate, less than half the Americans had even heard of Watergate. Mm. By the time Woodward and Bernstein had pretty much nailed Nixon dead to rights by Election Day in November 1972.
The movie shows scenes in which Bob Woodward meets with his source, Deep Throat. Do you think it would have been unusual for a newspaper editor like Ben Bradley to trust a young reporter with an anonymous source?
Well, I think that the way that source worked, I mean, he was very careful not to give them anything positive, but just kind of
point them in the direction of where the story was. Mm-hmm. So they didn't actually source anything to Deep Throat. He was just kind of like their Beatrice, their guide to the underworld, as it were.
Many people believe that Deep Throat advised Woodward to follow the money, but that's an invention of William Goldman, who wrote the screenplay. Mm-hmm. Is that all that much different from when Oliver Stone invented certain details? Rick, as a historian, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think that it has a poetic truth to it, in that it really was in kind of unraveling the trail of checks and $100 bills with, you know, consecutive serial numbers that they were able to get at the case. I think that it rhymes with history in a way that I found the direction, the basic kind of vector of the Stone film did not.
And I wonder, Brian, whether you think it would have been as effective if it had gone on past the first 7 months of the after the Watergate break-in to Nixon's resignation.
No, I think its structure is this dogged investigation, so that we, although we know what's coming when we watch the film in 1976, certainly the energy of it is generated from these kind of close shots, telephone shots, depth of field in the newsroom, and the sudden cuts to the underground car park and to these, I think it did at the time really. There was a certain sort of unwillingness to question the presidency, and you get all the way to a film like Dick, and where there are no real expectations of great probity in the White House anymore.
Now, you mentioned, Brian, that Dick didn't have much of an audience in the UK, but did the other two? Are British audiences interested in movies about American presidents?
Absolutely. I mean, I think these two, well, I think Nixon less so, because I think he was less successful, but All the President's Men certainly traded on the huge coverage of Watergate here, and even Nixon to some extent played on that kind of global post sort of satellite imagery, the global village, what McLuhan called. You know, Nixon was a kind of classic case for someone as a baby boomer growing up like myself, is certainly going back to the Hiss case and the Pumpkin Papers and the Checkers speech and his debate with Khrushchev and the kind of debate with Nixon, with Kennedy in 1960. I think that mythology was very, very important and powerful in Britain, and at a time when British politics was less than enticing.
Well, it's interesting to compare the way the American journalists worked and the way British journalists worked. You can't imagine a similar film being made about News of the World reporters writing about Max Mosley.
Yeah. No, there have been attempts at conspiracy theory, conspiracy films, and Ken Loach tried one, but there's no real comparison, I think, with the kind of degree of power and that is associated with American politics, and with the mix of political and economic and industrial interests that that Oliver Stone certainly hints at.
Well, Rick, do you think that this sort of investigative journalism could be conducted today? Or,
well, it wasn't conducted then. I mean, the fascinating
they
thing,
were unique.
Yeah, I mean, if you read if you read Boys and the Bus, which is a book that always repays rereading, I think it's one of the great books, not just about journalism but about politics. They were the only guys on the case because basically, it's referred to in the movie. Mm-hmm. Well, we should put a Washington reporter on this. We should put a White House reporter on this. It was only the fact that they were these police reporters who were, so hungry. You know, Bernstein had just had a divorce and had almost been fired, and were willing to put in these 20-hour days. No other papers were picking up the story because the Washington Post owned it, because they were so out on a limb. And as a matter of fact, since only the Washington Post was really following the story, it really helped Nixon's public relations from people like Clark McGregor and Ron Ziegler and Bob Dole to be able to say, well, this is just the vendetta of one liberal newspaper. And that's part of the reason, only 50% of the country had heard of Watergate, and indeed why Nixon and Ziegler were very rarely asked about it until the congressional committees convened the next year.
Today, it probably would be easily dismissed as having reflected the liberal bias of a newspaper.
Yeah, I think it would, and that's referred to in the film as well, when the woman slams the door in Woodward and Bernstein's face and says, "Don't you even know what loyalty is?" You know, this idea that's kind of central to Nixon's appeal and his fascination that, you know, America is in this tribal war between sort of the forces of kind of rationalism and secularism and duty and honor. And it really is, in that sense, a liberal film, I think,
yeah.
In that it invests, you know, no mystique in the trappings of power and honor, and you know, it shows very little respect for the office of the presidency, even by not even showing the president.
Well, it sure increased applications to journalism schools for a time.
Yeah.
But in the end, we haven't seen all that much of a change.
No.
Can we trust a film to give us a true sense of history? The old Hollywood biopics were never accurate in any way. But for many people who grew up after these events took place, they will be taken as fact. As I mentioned earlier, people will still assume that Deep Throat said, "Follow the money."
Right. I mean, I think that you know, the role of art is, you know, the lie that tells the truth, right? And I think that something like All the President's Men, I think, you know, does that effectively. And it does that effectively because the Watergate story, and this is another reason why it wasn't covered very much at the time, was very complicated and confusing. And it did a real civic duty in kind of wrapping it up into a relatively compact package so people could understand the drama of it. And, you know, I think in a fairly responsible way. You know, it's up to critics and critical movie viewers to decide for themselves whether a film does honor to the, not necessarily the historical record, but, you know, so the general outlines of history as it happens.
Yeah. Brian, we have about 15 seconds left.
Can I add just, I mean, it seemed to be a consensus film. It was one of the big selling films of 76, and, you know, I don't think, you know, I think that kind of consensus has gone, and they tried to suggest,
yeah,
a bit of conflict there between the Republican and the Democrat investigators, but the cultural divide now is much greater than that film then suggests.
Brian Neve is the professor of cultural studies at University of Bath in England, author of the upcoming book, Ilya Kazan, The Cinema of an American Outsider, which will be published this December. Rick Perlstein is the author of Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'm a longtime listener.